Well, please allow me this opportunity to offer thanks once again to His Excellency and all the priests and the seminarians who are such good hosts anytime I come here. This has become a little hideout away for me, a home away from home, and it's always a joy to come over and partake of their hospitality. So I thank them very much, and it's been a delight seeing so many of you, making some new friends and seeing some old faces. It's been a delight. I'm indeed vanishing right after this lecture. As I said, I'm off to babysit. The word from Minneapolis is both the little children have slight ear infections and are very cranky. So that's this is what I'm heading into. When I spoke to my brother last night, he said he's not sure he's going to be able to pull his wife away. I don't know if you heard about it, but there was a huge milk recall. The chance that some milk had been, some sort of, who knows what, had gotten into the milk supply. Land O'Lakes was recalling all sorts of milk. And of course, my sister-in-law went to the refrigerator and discovered that one quart of milk had the number on it. And she had given some of that milk to my little niece 6 days ago. And she called the doctor frantically, and the doctor said, had there been a problem, the little girl would have been sick by now, so it's not a worry. Did you mix it with other milk? Yes, I mixed it with other milk. Then there's nothing to worry about. But of course, my sister-in-law is distraught that she may have poisoned her own daughter. So never forget the joys of family life. There are all these things that go on out there. One other thing, and I'll actually move into my discussion today via this route. Many of you have spoken to me of bumping into my former students out there. It's good to know they're still out there. It's even better to know that they are still maintaining the faith and getting to your chapels. And that for me is a great consolation, because conversion is difficult enough in these days. Perseverance is also a difficulty given the nature of the world. So that is very good news. But something interesting happened from two of the good fathers that I spoke to during this week. On both occasions, I was told that they had seen former students of mine who indeed had converted, and that they were at the chapel and they said hello. But then it was followed by tales of how much the parents hate me. And if there is a dark side to the good news of seeing these students convert, seeing them come to the truths of the Catholic faith, and having many of them stay in touch with me, I hear from them occasionally over the years and know how they're doing, there is the knowledge that at the same time, their families detest me. I know of homes where my name cannot be spoken. In one case, very interesting, a young man, very, very bright, who I had as a plebe when he first arrived at the academy, and he was one of the easy ones. He sat in that class and listened, and then would come in and sort of make the connections for me and began asking about the faith. I mean, some of these conversions are wrestling with the devil, and others are just a gift you're given. Well, this young man was a gift. But the word from his mother, he thinks we're going to hell. And it's very curious, because I've had the same accusation come from my parents. You know very well that I do not sit down over the meatloaf at the family meal at night and say, Mom, Dad, you're going to hell. And I know this young man has not done the same. It is actually a mark of grace in seeing the child become Catholic that it stirs up this in the parents. It is a good sign. But the other point I want to make is that it operates the other way as well. In some sense, conversion would not be possible were it not for the good work the parents had done. What the parents cannot understand is that the conversion of the child to the Catholic faith is a compliment to them, even if they weren't Catholic. It means there was something good and solid in the upbringing. Let me give you another example. Father Bebo mentioned to me, I have only in the many years, and there's something to this, seen two females convert. One of them is one of the few who's fallen away from the faith, which I'm very sad about. And it's again a problem of perseverance, which in some ways is difficult for women in this world. The other is a delightful young woman who is a United States Marine Corps officer. I'll pause while you try to get that into your head. She is absolutely delightful. She is feminine. She was not the most brilliant student, but a good student. She plays the bass. I mean, she's rather tall, and she plays the bass quite well. I mean, again, just... She is eccentric in good ways, but she came to the faith, her parents just livid. I'm not popular in that household. And she converted after she had gone into the Marine Corps. It was shortly after her graduation. Her last few years, she was going to Mass at Father Ringrose's chapel. And then what happened? She converted, was at Quantico at basic training, went to the commandant of Quantico, the Marine training base at Quantico, Virginia, and said, I have to give up my flight billet. She was lucky enough to get one of the billets where she could be trained to fly airplanes. These are hard to come by. They fight for them. He said, why are you doing that? She said, because I don't believe women should be in combat. I have no business flying airplanes. Put me at a desk job. He said to her, well, then why did you take a flight billet? She said, well, there's been a major change in my life. He said, what's that? She said, I've become Catholic, and I don't believe women should be in combat. He said, well, I'm a Catholic, and I have no problem with it. Whereupon they apparently had a very interesting two-hour discussion. She got her wish. She's doing desk jobs. Father Bebo just told me, I think this is wonderful. She now feels very uncomfortable. She's an officer. She says she feels uncomfortable leading men. She doesn't feel she has any business as a woman giving men orders. So she tends to let one of her sort of upper in the rank enlisted often lead them. Because, I mean, good, healthy instincts. Again, this is what the Catholic faith can do. This keeps up. Women won't want to be in the military. But she now believes she may have a vocation. Time will tell, we don't know, but I can guarantee to you it will be the first Catholic nun to have also been a United States Marine Corps officer. God works in amazing ways sometimes. But needless to say, when she told her parents this, they were extremely upset and furious at her, at me, at the Catholic Church. But my point again is this. What they don't understand, that I hope they can come to understand someday, is that they had done good work. And what we have here, and let me go back to the parable that I began my first lecture with, from last Sunday's gospel. So much depends on where that seed falls that the sower is sowing. And what is most instructive in some way for our time is that seed that falls upon the rock and gets no moisture. That seed cannot grow. And we live in a time when there is more and more rock, or let me put it another way, where the ground itself is baked, hard, dry. There is nothing to receive the seed. And before we can hope for the seed to grow, we have to prepare the ground. We have to break up that ground. We have to get moisture into that ground. If you try to even water hard ground, the water will run off. You can't even moisturize it. You've got to break up that ground before the water will go in. And if it's soil that has been sun-baked and hardened, then it may need some kind of fertilization before the seed can grow. In our time, and it's what makes us unique, that's what's happened in the world, and we have to prepare the ground to receive the seed. In the past, even with the beginning of the falling away and the heresies of Protestantism, there was still enough Catholic culture around that the culture itself, and of course, from the In one sense of the word, that which makes things grow, the place where they grow, agriculture. Those of you that worked in a lab making little culture in order to grow samples in, okay? Culture is that which, in a way, allows things to grow, prepares it to grow. We've lost that. Catholic culture, one of the glorious proofs in my mind of the truth of the faith, And in fact, one of the things that brought me toward the Catholic faith and my own conversion to the Catholic Church was that glorious heritage of Catholic culture. And that was, to a large degree, for me, the art, the music, the literature, the beauty, that had an attraction. And that had created, that was something that was still out in the world. So that when you toss that seed, the ground was receptive to the seed. The seed had somewhere to land, and you could get about the business of helping the seed to grow. That time is past. And part of the job now is to prepare the ground to receive the seed. Let me give you another example. Third student. This is a tough case I'm still working on. This has gone on for 5 years now. Brilliant young man, but raised in a Calvinist home. And I mean a strict Calvinist home. And when he came into my class, when he first arrived at the academy, a brilliant mind, wrote very well, but it was like automatic writing. Subject goes here, verb goes here, prepositional phrase goes here, bah, period, okay? It was, it was like an automaton writing. And it was perfect in the way a machine can turn out something that seems to be perfection, but boy, there was no heart, there was no personality, and he would sit in class, and when he knew the answer to something, and I'd call on him, he would give me the answer, and it would be absolutely correct, and that would be that. And was like, well, yes, that's right. Is there anyone there? Okay, just... Now, he was also absolutely humorless. I would stand in front of the class and toss jokes in his direction, and the rest of the class would laugh, and he would sit there just stony-faced. Not funny. I'm saved. You're not. Okay? Now, given the quality of the mind and something that I could tell that was very good, because occasionally he dropped by my office, and he's one of those, when he saw the Catholic Encyclopedia, just went, you know, we would have debates that would rage, that would go on for hours, but he would always come to a point where I would begin to score something and he'd leave, and then just dismiss it from his mind. Well, but he kept signing up for courses from me. He kept taking more courses. And finally, one day, I happened to mention in class the Beethoven String Quartet, Opus 132 in A minor. Don't ask me why. Oftentimes, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I always pray before I go into class and ask that God will guide my lips and make my will his will, and oftentimes I don't know what's coming out of my mouth or what it will do, and this was one of those cases. For some reason, I'm talking about the Beethoven A minor string quartet. He comes into my office a week later and says, you know, after you mentioned that, I got on my bicycle and rode out to the CD store here, which is, those of you that tried to bicycle in an East Coast city know what that's like. I found it, I bought it, I've listened to it, it's very good. I said, yes, it is. He said, that's very beautiful music. I don't understand it yet. I need to get to understand it. I said, well, yes, you probably do. I said, but realize it's one of his last quartets. And the best way to get to know it is by getting to know the other quartets. He said, I'll have to do that. Well, I ran out and bought him a complete set of the Beethoven string quartets. Okay? Understand, the reason I'm doing this, the reason I'm buying the young man Beethoven, is to try to move him towards the Catholic faith. This may seem odd, but it is breaking up the ground. Before I can talk to him about anything, I have to humanize him. His Calvinism has made him rigid and inhuman. I gave him the quartets, and even though he has left the academy, graduated, this is ongoing, and he'll write me occasionally, and in typical fashion, he's working his way through them one at a time. Okay? But by the time he left, he was smiling in class, he was laughing, he would go out with the other midshipmen to eat pizza. There was some personality. No, seriously, seriously, this was a major triumph. This was a major triumph. One of the shocks of my career was when they invited me out to dinner one night, a group of midshipmen. I went with them. We went to a Vietnamese restaurant. He ordered a beer. I received 2 weeks ago a letter from him and a long essay he was submitting to the Marine Corps magazine. It's a monthly magazine that's put out for the Marine Corps. His point in the article was, I'm a young Marine Corps officer. I believe in the Marine Corps. I've studied the history of the Marine Corps. I'm proud to be a Marine, but something awful is happening. The Marine Corps I have entered seems to be a Marine Corps that is obsessed with paper pushers, bureaucrats, and robots. Men who can run machines. What happened to the concept of the warrior? The complete personality. The man who was the fighting man who knew philosophy and poetry and history and would go out as a complete human being to fight. Well, you can imagine the effect that had on me. Because he was absolutely right. He had learned a very important lesson, and the lesson he learned was something he's now putting forward to the Marine Corps. I'm praying like fury for him right now. Something very good is happening, and there is hope there. And of course, I put all of these hard cases under the protection of Our Lady, and she's never failed me yet. So I am filled with hope, and just in God's good time, I'm sure this young man will enter the Catholic Church. My point is this. When humanism came during the Renaissance and focused man's attention on man himself, and elevated man at the expense of God, those people who were doing that did not mean to exclude God. But they did. That was the result of their humanism. And it was a terrific loss, and a loss that they could not have anticipated. When the next big change after the Enlightenment came, and the world became a world of science and machines and technology, those people who built that world did not mean to exclude humanity, but they did. As the humanists neglected God and lost God, the scientists and the engineers and those with the mechanical vision neglected the human and lost basic humanity. In order to restore man to God, you must first restore man, humankind, to man. And it is a difficult task. In one sense, I now view the process of conversion as a two-step task. Before I can get these young students to God, I have to restore their humanity. I have to get them back to the point where they are human enough to connect with nature, to connect with the world around them, to begin to understand what it means to be human, and then what it means to connect with God. And it's a tougher chore. And I say, thank goodness I have the fruits of Catholic culture, Western civilization, that I can give to them, because that's the way I'm going to do it, and that's why I've been here this week talking to you about Shakespeare, because I have found him one of the best ways to do this. And he can be very valuable in keeping, even for those who have the faith, even for young people who have the faith, keeping them rich in humanity so that they will be open to God's grace. Does this mean you neglect their prayer life? You neglect serious spiritual reading? Of course not. And time is a problem. All I am saying is when the time comes that they need some diversion or need something to study, then let them be diverted by or study that which is the best, which will keep them fully human and draw them toward that which is eternal, unchanging. Shakespeare will be swept away in the twinkling of an eye. We know that. But right now, this is a great tool God has given us at this time, and I believe it's important to keep that in mind. That's in a way the process that I work through in trying to convert. And it seems to take pretty well because of the many students I've seen convert. I've only seen two who have fallen away. The rest are still very solid in the faith, and that's a great encouragement. And they are devoted to Mother Church. They are devoted to their prayer life. They are devoted to the sacraments. And they read good books and listen to good music and go to the art gallery and look at good art. And that goes hand in hand, because that is our Catholic heritage. in 1992, there was a big art exhibit at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. in honor of the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage. Well, of course, as soon as they announced it, the voices who hate Columbus rose up. You can't just have a white, you can't, it's all going to be Western European art. And you can't do that because that's exclusive and that's just all that. All right, fine. So what they said was, all right, what we will do is we'll gather some artworks from the East as well. We'll find some Oriental art from the same period. We'll include that. So we will have all the Western art and we will have the Eastern art. Well, you can't just do that. What about South America? There were all those Indians down there, and they were there, and they had their culture too. And all right, fine. We'll have three parts. We will have Western European art, and we will have the Eastern Oriental art, and we'll find art from those Indian tribes. All well and good. To go through the exhibit was to get a walking lesson in the Catholic faith. You walked into the Western art from 1492, and it was gorgeous, magnificent, complex, interesting, loaded with Catholic thought, loaded with it. Let me give you an example. There was a painting by Leonardo da Vinci that had never been in the West before. It was from Poland. It's kept in some small art museum in Poland. How they got it, I don't know. The painting is of a woman, beautiful woman, upper-class woman, holding an ermine. One of those white minks, okay? A living ermine. All the painting is the woman holding the ermine in her arms. It is gorgeous to look at. And many people looked at and walked by. What is it about? It is about mastering the passions. What's behind that painting is a Catholic thought. The little ermine, that sweet little white mink, is one of the nastiest creatures on God's green earth. It's savage. It bites. It'll rip you apart. It's, you know... The point being, you can't pick up and hold an ermine. You can't pet a nice little ermine. What is Da Vinci saying? What have we got there? We have beauty, and of course, to the Renaissance mind, that's connected with truth and the good. Beauty mastering the animal passions. And that ermine is content in her arms. You can't look at that painting and not somehow be given a sense of the mastery of control, intellect, beauty, goodness over animal passion. It's there. There were hundreds of other examples, okay? Little Albrecht Dürer drawings of dead birds. Beauty in death. How can death be beautiful? The Greeks wouldn't have understood that. A Catholic mind can understand that. Tiny little drawing. Teaching lessons, okay? Again, what did you need? You needed a guide to tell you what was there. But this stuff was beautiful. You walked into the Oriental room, what did you find? Two things. Some beautiful works of art. Credit where credit's due. Some lovely things. Most of them pen and ink drawings or simple pen drawings on paper. Only two subject matters. As opposed to the Western art that was infinite in its subject matter and what it was talking about. Only two things. The beauties of nature in which mankind is this tall. Huge waterfalls, magnificent mountains, wonderful huge trees, and little bitsy tiny men and women walking around. It's an Oriental idea. Nature is overwhelming and magnificent and endures, and man is nothing. That's not a Catholic idea. And the other was the great warlord crushing masses of people. Big, fat, Oriental, powerful warlords being carried around by these poor little peasants, okay? Horrible vision. Genuinely unpleasant. Not a Catholic vision either. And those were the only two subject matters. But within that, some impressive things to look at, but you got to the third area. Giant stone heads of a serpent. And a stone pot. If they had wanted to insult those cultures, they could not have done a better job. Savagery, barbarism, and of course we know what that stone serpent is all about, don't we? Enormous, I will never forget it, this enormous stone serpent head with the tongue sticking out. And you look at it and you say, well, that's fortunately what Our Lady of Guadalupe came to crush. Your dead meat, Okay? Right under her heel. At which point the beauty and richness of those cultures began to manifest themselves. You cannot have culture without the Catholic faith. You can't have it. That's our treasure house. That is now necessary, as I said, to restore especially young people who go to school and sit before a computer screen and come home and watch a television screen and go out at night with their friends to see a movie in front of a movie screen. They don't know what a tree is. They've never seen one. Unless in a digital printout from their computer. I mean, when was the last time, and some of you have probably seen it, and God be praised for it, children out playing in nature. A little boy climbing a tree to look at a bird nest. I never see it. I never see kids out playing anymore. I mean, at least we played cowboys and Indians, you know. And if not politically correct, but we were out there and, you know, breaking twigs off the trees and chasing each other around and pounding on each other until we were caught. But at least we were out in nature, you know. If there was water, we'd be in it. We knew what water was. I'm not sure they know anymore, except, you know, that's what comes out when you turn on the tap. And you make the ice to go in your Coca-Cola. I don't, you know. That's what they are. Now, I am basically making a case, and this is something that I think should be open to debate, should be talked about. How far should we go in this direction? How important is it? What good can it do? These are things that honest, serious men of goodwill can talk about. It's our heritage. It's there. I'm putting it forward as something that can be very useful. But there are many questions that surround that that deserve discussion. You are the ones out there fighting your particular battles in your parishes, and you should be discussing this. There are decisions for you to make. And there is not one hard and fast rule. Much of it depends on the people you are with and who you know and what is presented to you. All roads lead to Rome, which is absolutely true, but boy, that's a lot of roads. Because there are a lot of different people walking down them, and in the many conversions I've been fortunate enough to witness, no two have been similar. No two have ever been similar, but then I'm sure that's something you know as well. Now, what I want to do in my remaining time this morning is just a quick overview of, you know, this is a big book, what do I do with it? Okay? So, let me do it this way. Shakespeare himself would be absolutely appalled at the notion that we might be sitting down with a book and reading his plays. I have no doubt his first response would be, "What are you doing that for? Why don't you act them?" So that the best thing you can do is get the young people in your parish, get those young people around you, bring in a few adults, and do some scenes. Get it up there. I guarantee you in most cases you will not be selected to go on a national tour. That's not going to happen. Okay? But it is valuable nevertheless. The experience is valuable, first and foremost. Then read through it. Okay? Then you can do some study of it. Again, depending on the level. For those who are young, just help them through it. What's the plot here? What's going on? Who are these characters? I mean, I remember sitting down to read The Merchant of Venice. Who is Salernio? How's he different from Salanio? Who's Graziano? Who's Bassanio? Well, these aren't names, okay? But I had a teacher there to help explain, and pretty soon I realized, oh, okay, these are different human beings, sure enough. That simplest level, you can do that sort of thing. Let me repeat, memorization, memorization, memorization. Those long speeches are treasures they will carry for the rest of their days. Make them memorize. They can do it. They'll complain. They complain about everything. So what? Okay? Make them memorize. We've lost it completely. One of my dear friends was an elderly lady, a neighbor, died at the age of 89. We sat down. She was always quoting things. I said, "Where did you learn that?" She said, "Third grade. We had to memorize it." One afternoon, I said, "Okay, sit down. Just recite for me. Just recite. I want to hear what you've got up there." She went on for over 2 hours. Chunks of Shakespeare, whole books of the Bible, Longfellow's The Ride of Paul, Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. I was exhausted finally. I said, "How?" She said, "Oh, most of it I learned. Most of it I learned in grade school." But the fact of the matter is, and we know this, short-term memory is the first thing to go. Okay, I couldn't tell you what I did half an hour ago, but I can still quote, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. And I learned that when I was 13. Okay? That's going to stay with me. And again, that's why you teach the children their prayers and their catechism. That's why you make them memorize scripture when they're young, because they're not going to be able to get rid of it. It's not going to go. It's going to remain there. Okay? And then as they grow older, you can begin to explore it more and more. It is better for them to know Twelfth Night very well over 6 years than to be scattered around reading 100 different things. Okay? There's nothing wrong with focusing. Don't feel you have to teach everything. Teach a few things very well. Make those few works companions that they will carry for a lifetime. And you will give them a great service. If you're lucky enough to have a theater nearby, take them to see something live on stage, but check it out first. The crazies are loose. You don't know what you'll get. Never, ever send them into a theater or a movie house without your knowing what it is they're going to see. That is just prudential in the awful age in which we live. And when you check it out, make prudential judgments. And that has to do with, if there's something that's not good, is it so bad that it will invalidate the good that is there? That's a prudential judgment. But let me give this little warning again. It's something I mentioned already. Let me put it in a different way. Why does not the body language in Shakespeare trouble me? Why, when I teach Chaucer, do I have no trouble teaching the Miller's Tale, which is about as bawdy as a tale can get? Because the context is Catholic, the storyteller is a master, and I can trust him. And just as we combat disease by inoculating with a tiny bit of that virus or bacteria that will cause death, you put a tiny bit in and it will build up resistance and protect in the long run. Which is why you would not send that same young person to see a modern movie. That would be to expose them completely to tuberculosis. But to give them a little bit in Chaucer or Shakespeare is to inoculate them. A sense of it, build up resistance, not threatened by it, and they'll be able to handle it better. It's in the proper context. I would view those small things, or even a big thing like the Miller's Tale, but I would never teach it out of the context of the Knight's Tale and the Parson's Tale. Okay? In context, you are inoculating them. And therefore, I believe they will build up resistance. Now, quick overview of what's in this big book. What do you teach them? What do they study? One last thing. I'll say this very quickly. The movies. There are a lot of them out there. You view it first. Make a prudential decision. You can tell. The Kenneth Branagh Hamlet, uncut. There are graphic sex scenes with Ophelia. It's terrible. He ruined it. No, shouldn't. I wouldn't even show it in my class to young grown-ups. I wouldn't do it. Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing. I do show in class. There is that, instead of talking out the window, there is a glimpse of a couple making the beast with two backs, as Shakespeare calls it. It's quick, it passes. Father Doran doesn't think it should be seen. I can agree with his judgment. I show it to my secular students for a reason. They take away something very positive from it. You have to make that decision. You must make that judgment. And you can do it. You will have a sense of it. That's why you preview. There is no longer an index out there. The church doesn't do it. You have to be a personal index and make that decision. This perhaps is a great good. No, this cannot be seen. Now, very quickly, here's something interesting. Shakespeare's plays are usually divided into three categories: the comedies, the histories, the tragedies. That's not my division, and I'll tell you why. I make a different division. The division I make has to do with the progress in his career. And when I teach the course, I teach the development of the man's thought process, because we can follow it in the play. And when I teach it, I divide it this way. Early in his career come the comedies. followed by the tragedies, and then at the end of his career, a series of four magnificent plays, too little known, known as the Romances. The history plays come at the same time that he's writing the comedies. And in a curious way are a kind of subset. You have a couple very great tragedies, Richard III, Richard II, in which he is experimenting, moving toward his next period, trying to figure out how do you write tragedies. And then you have in the histories this vision of lived life that is very often comic. It is not accidental that Shakespeare's greatest comic creation comes in one of the history plays, Sir John Falstaff. Falstaff, one of the incomparable creations of the human imagination. Every single thing you don't want a human being to be, rolled into one bundle and given charm beyond belief, okay? If you want the complexity of human life, it's in that character. It is, and yet Shakespeare does something with that character that is unheard of, that you never ever do with a comic character. Falstaff dies off stage during Henry V. And he dies crying out, God, God. Something unheard of in a comedy, but again, that's the complexity of lived life as this man presents it, okay? Greatest comic character, in the, that's why I call the histories part of the comedies, extensions of the comedies. They're well worth studying. They're well worth studying. Particularly the tetralogy, the four plays, Henry IV, Richard II, Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, Henry V. A great Kenneth Branagh film of Henry V. You can show it to anyone, anytime. And then get the boys up, give them wooden swords, and let them pound on each other, okay? While they shout some of the lines. It's well worth the doing, okay? There's an old Olivier Henry V that's very good, but it's at this point about 60 years old, but they would prefer the newer one, I would guess, okay? Now, there's a curiosity here. You may have noticed it. I taught Shakespeare for a quarter of a century before it dawned on me. This is the shape of Shakespeare's career. The early comedies, born out of the exuberance of youth, a vision of innocence, the delights of the world, all of which, most of which, there's one exception, end in marriage. One ends in a marriage deferred for a year. All comedy grows out of the wedding feast of Cana. All comedy grows out of the wedding feast of Cana. The vision of the marriage and the extraordinary joy, the happiness of such an occasion. Shakespeare understood that. There is a reason why at that moment when they ran out of wine, our Lord turned water into wine so the party could continue. It's an extraordinary thing. How my Calvinist friend gets around that, I don't know, okay? Maybe I pointed that out to him. It may be one reason he had a beer that night. I don't know. But in any case, it is a vision. It's an extraordinary vision. Then he moves into the tragedies. You see the doubt creeping up in some of the later comedies. There are the handful of dark comedies. Don't teach them. And except to your better students, older students, All's Well That Ends Well, an ironic title, Measure for Measure, Troilus and Cressida, three difficult and dark plays. They're magnificent, but they're for those who are older, who have done some study. But it leads into the tragedies. A period of doubt, trouble, wrestling with ideas, trying to figure things out. I'll come back to it in a moment. And he moves out of that. He gets through it, and having done so, reaffirms his faith. The greatest loss in English literature is that at the end of his career, when Shakespeare was confirmed in his own mind again with the complete truths of the Catholic faith, he could not write openly about them. And as a result, the last four plays are little fairy tale stories, romances, magical, delightful, loaded with Catholic theology. And all of them moving towards a vision of the rewards awaiting the good and the just. And they end, all of them, with a kind of heavenly vision. I'll come back to that in a moment. The point I'm making about the pattern in the plays is simply this. What are the comedies? I made it clear. Innocent Joy. What happens? The world that surrounded the man overwhelmed him. The religious chaos, the doubt, the philosophical questioning, and he fell into a black, black period. And at the end of his life, having come through that, he has a vision of heaven and the joys that await the good in that heavenly city. You'll notice what we have there. I was lecturing on Shakespeare at the von Hildebrand Institute and discussing my vision of the pattern of his career, and honestly, it was like a bolt out of the blue. It was being knocked in the face. The shape of Shakespeare's career follows the mysteries of the rosary. It's just... And through my whole career, many of my colleagues teach the plays sort of randomly. I have always taught them in order. Always taught them in order and insisted on a progress. From the youthful, joyful vision through that dark complexity, the trials and sorrows and pains of this world and suffering, onto that final vision of... How I missed it all those years, I don't know. I'm dumb. Maybe there was a reason I had to wait that long, but there it is. The pattern of Shakespeare's career follows the pattern of the mysteries of the rosary. Not equal to it, but can help us to understand certain things. Again, this is secular work. But there are things we can learn from it. Now, let me run through these plays. Early comedies. If you've got junior high students, give them The Comedy of Errors. It's a very early play. It is delightful. There is a lot of knockabout comedy in it. The language is fairly easy. Get them up doing it. They'll have a wonderful time. The Comedy of Errors. The most useful of the early comedies. If you have students a little older, high school age students, a very interesting play called The Two Gentlemen of Verona. Not terribly well known, fascinating play about friendship, and the title is very ironic because one of the two gentlemen is not a gentleman at all. And a wonderful place to discuss what it means to be a gentleman. What is a gentleman? What should a gentleman be? And what is the behavior we're seeing in this play? It's a wonderful play. The Two Gentlemen of Verona. Not very well known. Again, language is easy. You can get them upstage and stage the whole thing. Very, very useful. Again, one of the great plays, Taming of the Shrew. One of the great comedies, one of the great farces. The Zeffirelli film is magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. And what's the topic? Man and woman. Always pertinent. And the fact that there's combat between them, there always will be, but that doesn't mean there cannot be happiness as well. Once they agree to follow their God-given roles in this world. There's an extraordinary notion. There's a counter-revolutionary notion for you in our time. I think Love's Labor's Lost is in many ways too difficult. If you have a student who reads well, has read a lot of it, is willing to try it, it is, of all the early comedies, the one most rooted in its own time period, and it's about poetry, language, love, and it's difficult to read. Very difficult. One of those things you can hold out, though, as a challenge to a bright, good young student. Well, I don't know if you're ready for this. It would be wonderful for them. Now, if you're ready for this, it'll be tough for you, and, oh, I can do it, I can do it, all right, but it's not something you would want to teach generally. Then we come to a series of five great comedies. Always useful, can always be taught. These are the masterpieces of this early period. A Midsummer Night's Dream. Magical. A perfect play. A very strange play in that he takes four plots from four different sources. Greek mythology, Roman comedy, English folklore, and what I call the Three Stooges. Idiots just pounding on each other. He takes these four different plots and synthesizes them into one perfect whole. One of the glories of studying Shakespeare is it gives you a vision of how the world is one, the oneness of things, and that's a perfect play to do it. Those four plots should not combine at all, and yet they do. If you want to get your students to do plot diagrams, toss them A Midsummer Night's Dream and say, figure out how the four plots are presented here and how they interconnect, and make them draw it out. Give them big pieces of paper. Make them draw it out. A wonderful educational experience, and what they will learn is that the most disparate and different things in the world actually move towards wholeness, oneness. In the age of modernism, which is about fragmentation and breaking apart, it is a wonderful way to heal And what the play is about is the glory of the human imagination. And at that moment, Shakespeare himself realized with his own imagination what was possible. And from that point on, he was creating these magnificent, complete, coherent visions from whatever came his way. The Merchant of Venice. My chairman says it should not be taught because it's anti-Semitic. You as good Catholics can deal with this problem. It's a magnificent comedy. And it's about money and materialism and commercialism. It's about friendship. It's about love. It is about the division between Christian and Jew. And it is not a diatribe. Shakespeare is one of the magnificent creations. He is a real character. Shylock. Shylock is a real Jew. There's no getting around it. The moment when the Christian Lorenzo steals away his daughter Jessica and he rages about the house screaming, my daughter and my ducats and my daughter, because they take money with them. Okay? Three perfect golden comedies, Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, and Twelfth Night. Sheer joy, sheer delight. Glorious poetry. Magnificent vision of innocence and love. Much Ado About Nothing, a play about gossip and eavesdropping. Part of what goes on everywhere. As long as you get human beings together, they're going to be listening in on each other and talking about each other. I've even known it to happen in Catholic circles. As You Like It, a wonderful nature play. Both Midsummer Night's Dream and As You Like It, get them outside and do scenes under the trees, by the water. They are plays of nature. Get them out there. They may not have ever seen any of this stuff before. Twelfth Night, named, of course, for the last night of the Christmas festivities, before the Feast of the Epiphany. That last night of partying before the vision comes clear and we get on to the serious business of life once again. It is not accidental that the last of the golden comedies is called Twelfth Night, because it is a play with a kind of shadow in it. There is sorrow there. And he knew the comic vision was fading. He was moving towards something else. Twelfth Night. It's a beautiful play. Wonderful play. There is a film of it out recently. I haven't seen it yet. I've been told it's good. But I would definitely watch it myself before I ever showed it in class, okay? Then we're into the tragedies. Romeo and Juliet comes from early in the career. It's a kind of sketch. He's toying with notions of tragedy. Richard III, Richard II, both tragedies, magnificent. Richard III, a great barnstorming melodrama with one of the great villains ever. But it's also a play about conscience. And how conscience cannot be suppressed. Richard II, filled with some of his most glorious poetry. There are speeches in this play that they should memorize early on. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. Magnificent stuff. And then a transitional play. A play that's not taught much anymore, but a fascinating one, and that's Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar. Used to be taught all the time in high schools. It's disappeared for some reason. But it's a marvelous play. And again, the great oratorical speeches. Get them to learn them. They'll learn tons about rhetoric. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Okay? I come not to praise Caesar, but to bury him. The evil men do in their lives dies with them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. It's wonderful stuff. Make them little togas for themselves and stand up and recite. It's a wonderful exercise, okay? The four great tragedies. Hamlet, first and foremost. The one play where the modern world almost swamped him. The place where, I say, the modern world begins. The play of doubt, philosophical doubt, loss of faith, the coming of a dark vision of the world, mistrusting and suspecting everything. I'm going to be doing an extended analysis of this play over the summer at the little literature seminar that I'll be doing here. I'm sure it'll be on tape. But let me tell you one thing about Hamlet. And for me, this is central to understanding the play. Hamlet is called back from the university at the time of his father's death. He gets back to the castle at Elsinore thinking he's arriving for his father's funeral and learns that his mother has married his uncle. Double whammy. The funeral, and he tries to deal with it with humor. You know, his friend Horatio says, well, it happened rather fast, didn't it? And Hamlet says, thrift, Horatio. The funeral baked meats did coldly furnish forth the marriage board. Okay. They just, you know, we doubled them up so we could use the leftovers for the wedding. The important thing is, where is he coming from? The University of Wittenberg. That's not accidental. We know who was at the University of Wittenberg. We know what went on at the University at Wittenberg. Where is the philosophical doubt coming from? What has ripped the universe asunder? Why is this fellow carrying this load of doubt? Well, he was the first one to study at a modern university. It's destroyed many a fine brain and many a fine soul. We don't know that he studied under Luther there, but that reference to Wittenberg is not accidental. There's only one other character in all of Renaissance drama that's at Wittenberg, and that's Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, who makes the bargain with the devil. Hamlet and Dr. Faustus, the two Renaissance dramatic characters who are at the University of Wittenberg. Okay. By the end of Hamlet, the balance is regained. It's remarkable. It's a hard fight. There are still questions. It remains a problem play. But he recovers, and from that point on, he is into solid Catholic sense, even though there's an awareness now of what the world's like. And we get Othello, which challenges love itself. Love is put to the test and dissected. We get King Lear, where authority is put to the test. And we get the vision of a world in which authority vanishes. That's the world we're living in right now. The figure who's supposed to be in charge, who willingly gives up his own authority. The parallels to our own day and our own church are just overwhelming. And it's a play about pride. What it takes to break down pride in a man. Lear is a very oddly constructed play. Lear's tragic choice, and all these tragic heroes choose their own doom. They have free will. Lear's tragic choice takes place in Act One. He chooses to divide up his kingdom, trust those two wicked daughters, banish the good daughter, and banish the one counselor he can listen to honestly, whose name is Lefebvre. Excuse me, Kemp. Tossed out, okay? You get out of here. I'm not listening to you. You're exiled, okay? And then for five acts, he is beaten down and beaten down and beaten down and forced to recognize his error and forced to learn what it means to be a man, not a king. It's an extraordinary play. I go to Solzhenitsyn again. One of my favorite lines from the Gulag, pride grows on the human heart like lard on a pig. For that same reason, you just have to keep dieting and dieting and cutting it away and scraping it away. And then Macbeth. By the time he comes to Lear, he has reasserted there is the good in the world. The good exists. And the battle's going on out there. In Macbeth, he looks at the awful question, what happens when the good man falls into evil? And whenever I teach that now, I have to say to those students, those witches are not psychological projections of Macbeth's own inner self, which is what all the commentaries say now, the nonsense. No, they're real. They're agents of the devil. They're there to snare Macbeth's soul. That's what they're there for. And the other frightening aspect of that work, his lovely lady at home, the first feminist, there she is, who openly talks about killing her children in order to advance her own will. And throughout the whole play, a vision that we can contain and direct the future. The future is ours to control. There's a modern idea. And totally wrong. The future is in God's hand. We live in the present and try to have an awareness of what's coming, but it is up to God to design. It's a very, very frightening play. The last tragedy for advanced students, fascinating, brilliant, set in Rome, but loaded with Christian ideas, Coriolanus. Coriolanus. Never taught, never studied, never read, because it is the most anti-democratic play ever written. Shakespeare was not a fan of any kind of democratic principle. And in Coriolanus, he goes after democracy with a sledgehammer, which is why it's never taught in American schools. But it's a fascinating play. Fascinating play. And then finally, and quickly, let your Catholic students know these plays. They've been hidden. They've been hidden. They are the summit of his career. They are his greatest creations, except for one, The Tempest, the last, is fairly well known. The others are not known. Pericles, Cymbeline. Let me write these down for you. The Winter's Tale and The Tempest. The poetry is a little difficult, but if you don't tell them that, they won't know it. And whenever a student has trouble with the poetry, tell them to keep reading. There are passages in Shakespeare after 30, 40 years, I still don't know what they mean. It doesn't trouble me. He knew. They somehow make sense, you just keep going. And eventually, over time, sometimes they come clear. An evil king who in connection with his evil daughter whom he has corrupted puts a curse and blight on the hero. Evil king, evil daughter, Henry VIII, Elizabeth. Ooh, man. But it's a fairy tale play. Cymbeline, a king who refuses to do obedience to Rome and as a result loses his daughter, watches his kingdom come apart. But of course, it's Rome of the Romans. But at the end of the play, the king submits to Rome and his daughter is restored and the kingdom is healed and The Winter's Tale. A king in his madness accuses the queen of being disloyal. She's not really my wife. Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon. Bingo, right there. And as a result, and defies God, the gods, and as a result, loses everything. And then is forced to do penance for 14 years, and it ends with the restoration of his wife in Shakespeare's greatest dramatic triumph, where a woman we have believed is dead, the only secret Shakespeare ever withholds from the audience in any of his plays, returns to life. A statue comes back to life. The marble becomes flesh. It's a vision of the resurrection of the dead, and it's astounding, okay? Secular, fairy tale, but it's astounding. Audiences gasp, rise out of their seat. It's magnificent. And The Tempest, looking at himself in his last play, who was I? What did it all mean? Sums it all up in a fairy tale play of extraordinary beauty, complexity, richness, but you can take the children to it. You can take the children to it. It does what the greatest works of art do. Anybody can enter on that level and find something to delight and amaze. And in the epilogue, the last lines he wrote, where the character Prospero ends the play by saying farewell, where the actor ends the play by saying to the audience, I hope you liked us, please applaud a lot. Where Shakespeare, the playwright, says, I just finished my play, I hope you liked it, I hope you'll applaud a lot. Where Shakespeare, the playwright, says goodbye to the theater in London, hope you liked my career and all the plays I wrote, I'm retiring to Stratford. And where Shakespeare, the man, says, these are my last words, this is my farewell. The epilogue ends with Prospero saying, and my ending is despair. Unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. The echo of the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass, as you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. Pray for me. Pray for me, sacrifice for me. And it's not accident. It's not an accident. The word indulgence appears in the last line he ever wrote. Woo, was that a firecracker word back then? And what is he calling for? Do indulgences for me. My soul is in peril. I need your help. Pray for me. I still do, because I believe the man did great things in his career, left us a great legacy, and can be useful now to help bring others to the faith. I've seen it. Thank you very much. Oh, questions. I was talking about prayer and was ready to get right down on my knees. It's a good impulse. It's a good instinct, yes.
Very quickly to the place you were recommending for grammar school students, and you didn't start to reflect off stressing your breakdown of grade level.
Okay, let me say, the best thing for young students, the comedies, particularly Comedy of Errors, Midsummer Night's Dream. You could do scenes from The Tempest with them. You could do little bits from The Tempest with them. Those are best for the youngest students. They're grade school kids, too young for Romeo and Juliet, I think. You could get into some of the other comedies a bit. You could do a little Twelfth Night, a little As You Like It. But I would stick to the comedies and of the romances, The Tempest, the last of them. Then, a little older, feed in some of the other comedies, Two Gentlemen of Verona, Taming of the Shrew, and you can start them on the tragedies, Julius Caesar, Romeo and Juliet. Give them a taste of Hamlet and Macbeth early on. Let them wrestle a bit, get to know those things. And those older, those sort of high school age students can get to know the romances. Again, I would expose them to these early on. They are not well known. I think you will be astounded at the things you'll find in there. Just astounded. But wait till high school. There are accusations always made against good women in these plays. Men who go bonkers and accuse good virtuous women of not being virtuous. But one of the major themes of these plays is the good has a power that can overcome anything in this world. But that good is going to be challenged, hated, lied about, and tested in the extreme. The good will undergo great suffering. And it's well worth giving to high school students. I cannot emphasize enough the greatness of these plays, loaded with Catholic doctrine, loaded with the vision of the pure, immaculate woman who remains her goodness. He must have been devoted to Our Lady at the end of his life. He could not have created the heroines of these plays without that devotion. He understands purity, innocence, virginity, and the power of goodness. They always say the most difficult thing for an artist to do is create a believable good character. Shakespeare learned how to do it. And in those last plays, it's the women. They're just stunning. Just stunningly. Difficult to cast these days, sadly. Too many actresses have been around the block too much, and you cannot fake that purity on the stage. You can't do it. You can't act that. That's either genuine or it's not. Question, yes. Why? Yeah.
How do you, to your students, especially the female students, receive the image of Lady Macbeth?
They don't like it. They don't like it, but then they don't like a lot of things I say in class. The one thing I do is I keep an open classroom, and I will always let them question, challenge. I will not let it take over a class, but I'll have some back and forth. I lecture a lot in class. I believe a professor should profess something. I believe that I know more than my students do. This is a very old-fashioned notion. And therefore, I have things to teach them, to tell them. unlike most of my colleagues who go in and say, what did you think of Toni Morrison's Beloved? Did you like it? What did you like about it? Which characters did you like? What didn't you like? Oh, you didn't like that? Isn't that terrible the way we treat black people? It's called education these days. I will take questions. They come a lot. Okay. The one thing I've got going for me, and I've built it up over time, is authority. Doc White Shakespeare classes become legendary. Students fight to get into it. When they get there, they're always at least respectful. so that if they disagree, they will disagree with me respectfully because they know that I know what I'm talking about. So they'll bristle and be angry and challenge. And they're right to challenge. They have a right to question. So that I'll just engage them in a back and forth and try to explain my point of view. So I'm always open to questions and challenges, but I can usually prove my case. But again, what I do, I often do it in a Socratic method. Once they start questioning, I ask questions back. And I often make them do the work, and they end up at a place they didn't really want to be. I'm back teaching the Greeks a lot, especially to my beginning students. No logic, no thought, no order. And I teach a lot of, I always teach now one of the dialogues in my plebe course, just to try to get them to realize there's an order to thought, there is reason, there is logic, questions have answers and can take us somewhere. It's a bold new idea for them. It's not all just feelings and opinions, which is what they've been praised for all the time they've been going through school. But how do you feel about this? I mean, that's the most common question in most American classrooms. How do you feel about this?
You mentioned in order to get an understanding of some of the stories you use the lamb's tales.
For the youngest children. To introduce them to the youngest children. Let me put in a word here in praise of Mother Goose, Grimm's fairy tales, the Greek myths, and lamb's tales from Shakespeare. Get them to know that they're good stories. Often, you know, there's a lot there. Be very aware of that. There again is a lot of this in the Grimm version. They were appropriately named of Cinderella. The prince comes to try on the glass slipper that's been left at the ball, and the ugly stepsisters come down, and their feet won't fit, so they run upstairs and hack chunks of their feet off so that it will fit in. You know, as adults, we go, "Jeez, that's awful." The kids have no problem with it. It's just sort of, boy, they really are ugly stepsisters. They're so dumb. They're cutting up their feet. You know, it's just, and what they're more interested in is, well, is he good? Well, what about, oh yeah, Cinderella, oh, slipper fits, they're married, good. I like, that's fine. I mean, the children can, if it's time tested, Hans Christian Andersen, Brothers Grimm, Mother Goose, Greek mythology, they can handle that stuff. Do not go near the new stuff that's being published. Don't go near it. Trust that stuff that has been out there for decades and centuries and is time tested. There's a reason why for centuries this is what kids learned. And it has its value. Part of it coming to understand how narrative works. What stories are about. That there are struggles in the world, that there's good and evil out there. But the beauty about most fairy tales is that the good triumphs. That's why I call these fairy tale plays. For all of the struggles, all of the problems, good triumphs. That's what the fairy tale teaches. It's an important lesson. They're never too young to learn it. But it always demands virtue on the part of the hero and heroine. Always, always. The ugly stepsisters can't win. They can only hack up their toes. That's all they can do. Because they're lacking in virtue. And the kids recognize that. They'll know that. The coyote is never going to catch the roadrunner and eat it. Never. He's lacking in virtue. And he buys his hardware at a bad company. Don't buy from Apple.
Then as well as not being directly with the attached, we'll have to they have one of our teachers teach one of these courses. Is there obviously there's clip notes to help kind
yeah.
of
Yeah.
I wanted to explain a bit on the value of the clip notes. Or
okay, let me look, and I'm not saying this to sell books. I get nothing from it. There's a book out that I edited called Shakespeare A to Z. It's in all bookstores. I don't get a dime from it. If I did, I'd be living in Bermuda right now. I signed a flat contract. There are two things. There are two of the plays in which it's not good. I lost the battle. You'll understand why. Lost the battle on Merchant of Venice. There's some comments in there about it's anti-Semitic. It's nonsense. But I didn't remove my name from the book in spite of that battle. Okay, ignore that nonsense about the Merchant of Venice, and talks about Othello and Shakespeare's society seems to have been racist and not have liked blacks. Those are the two places I lost battles. Everything else in there is good commentary, decent commentary, straightforward commentary. It will give you a synopsis of the play. It will give you the background out of which the play came. And it will give you a decent, straightforward reading of what the play is. So at least you have some ground to stand on if you head into it. It's in most bookstores. It's called Shakespeare A to Z. And it's really an encyclopedia. You want to teach Pericles? Look under P. It's right there. And it will give you some guidance. I had some trouble. I won the Taming of the Shrew battle, and I won the Coriolanus battle. So I won a couple, but the two I lost were Merchant of Venice and Othello. That's occasionally we make small compromises. Yeah, hard to do. Yes.
Was Shakespeare influenced by most of things by Renaissance humanism? I think it's particularly influenced by his tragedy.
He was influenced by it. We know he was reading Montaigne. Right. Montaigne had an influence on him. And of course, the world that surrounded him, you know, had an influence on him. Montaigne was a huge influence. And yet, curiously, by the end of his career, Montaigne's influence is showing up in strange ways. He creates Caliban in The Tempest, and he takes it from Montaigne's essay on cannibals, and Caliban is not a likable character. But again, what we have there, and it's what I try to describe as the reason I think he wrote drama, there is tension between his medieval Catholic self and the Renaissance humanism that intellectually appealed to him in a way. And you get that battle raging. And as I say, I think in Hamlet it almost swamps him. He almost loses it. But from that point on, it is his medieval Catholic heritage that triumphs. You can find the other. It's there. He was a man of his age. How could he not be? It's there. Many of those ideas are there. But the medieval Catholic vision is always triumphant. And finally informs almost all that he does. But yes, he was influenced by it. No doubt about it. Montaigne first and foremost. First and foremost, yeah. There are speeches in Hamlet that obviously he had just been reading Montaigne. And they end up in there, yes. Thank you again.